Okay, so now we're starting the period of scholasticism. Mm. This is a period in the intellectual history of Europe. All right. It's an intellectual movement started in the 12th century through the 12th, 13th, and 14th century. It's a period in which Christianity in the West began to embrace scholarship. That the idea that you could ask a question and instead of killing you, they might try to actually answer that question. The absolute unquestioned authority of the rule of faith and the Catholic Church began to actually be chipped away at in some ways. The Scholasticism movement was not a rebellion movement against Rome, not at all. But people were given some freedom of thought. Scholasticism led ultimately to the Renaissance, all right, and to humanism. All right, so good or bad, you decide. And they use dialectical argument. Now, I'm so glad that Greg introduced the idea of dialectic yesterday. So basically, we have a dialectic. You have two things that seem to be opposed. You have two claims that be opposed. And then you decide which is true, and then you move forward from then, from there. That was the main mode of argument in the scholastic schools, which if you read stuff by these people, you go, man, you're scratching your head. Their mode of argument would not be like deductive reasoning like we would. They would have a series of yes and no proposals and then a discussion and then go on to the next one. So dialecticism was the principal means of teaching and learning. Now, during the scholastic era, the people they were studying were people like Cicero and Ovid. And Boethius, I didn't mention, he was one of the Christian scholars. So he was a Latin scholar in the 6th century. So primarily what they were doing was reading ancient authors and then talking about what they said and debating their conclusions. Very, very little original thought going on in the Scholasticism era, but a lot of consideration, debate, and discussion. How many angels can fit on the head of a pin? That's sort of the negative idea. And they would argue over how many angels you can put on the head of a pin. That's probably an over-the-top description of what was going on there. But it is kind of, sort of, what was going on there. All right.
Productive. Hmm? Yeah. Wasn't a very productive conversation.
I don't think so. And ultimately, to some extent, the Reformation was an anti-scholastic thing. To some extent, the Reformation was even anti-intellectual. Martin Luther was very intellectual. He was a professor at a university, but he utterly rejected scholasticism as being harmful to Christianity, just so you know. All right, so we're going to look at a number of these. The first one I'm going to mention, I don't have a picture of him. Actually, we don't have any pictures. These are all just some drawing. Who knows if that's what he looked like. That's not Peter. That is not Anselm of Canterbury. The first of the scholastics, as you can see in your notes, is Anselm of Canterbury. He said, I believe that I may know. So really, he's kind of a transitional guy. He said, I believe that I may know. So in other words, knowledge comes from faith rather than faith from knowledge. So he would not agree with people like Peter of Abelard or even Thomas Aquinas or William of Ockham or any of these Duns Scotus, Albertus Magnus. All right, so he's kind of a transitional figure. I believe that I might know. He's considered the father of scholasticism. He became the Archbishop of Canterbury. Anybody know where Canterbury is? It's in southeast England. It was the archbishopric that's fairly near when the Norman invasion happened. They kind of set up the thing there. And the Archbishop of Canterbury was the most important bishop in England and essentially kind of like the prelate of all England, although there was also the Archbishop of York, but whatever. Okay, great. All right, and he was a very strong supporter of the prerogative of the church. So there's this whole investiture controversy, which we don't care about very honestly very much in this class, but the bottom line is, who gets to appoint bishops? What are your two choices?
Pope.
The Pope or?
The
king. Kings. And Anselm of Canterbury was a very strong advocate of the prerogative of the church, of course. He's a monk and a bishop, so it's not too surprising. Okay. Anyway, he was a brilliant author and the greatest scholar of his period by far. There's no even close second to him. He created the cosmological argument, which is basically, God is the uncaused cause. That was a logical argument for the existence of God. He created the ontological argument, the thing that then which nothing greater can exist has to exist. All this is philosophical stuff. I hear the ontological argument and my eyes start rolling up, so I'm not even going to bother to mention it. But people are into this stuff, kind of into philosophical arguments. Man, the ontological, I mean, that's so awesome. That is so boring to me. But whatever. So basically, they're beginning to apply philosophy and reasoning and eventually Aristotle to try to explain Christianity on an intellectual basis. All right, now, I want to talk about a sort of a debate here. Now, this is not a debate we're probably going to care about so much. We're going to have two main schools of philosophy. We're going to have realists. And we're going to have nominalist. All right? So all philosophers in this time would line up either as a realist or a nominalist. Okay? Now, a realist says certain things exist in and of themselves. For example, a realist would say good is a thing. They would say love is a thing. They would say the church is a thing. And so they believe in the reality of concepts. This is very much an idea from Plato, not the stuff your kids are using. Not Plato, Plato. Plato. This is Plato's philosophy. And by the way, Augustine was very much a Plato, not Aristotle thing. Throughout the Middle Ages, Plato, if any Greek scholar was influencing things, it was quite indirect because they weren't even studying the Greeks. But if they had been, it would have been Plato. All right, so anyway, good is a thing. And here's a good question. Remember I asked the question early on, what is evil? Is evil a thing? I'm not against that question. But we're going to try to let. I told you I'm losing it here. I'm going to have trouble. Thomas Aquinas. We're going to try. Thomas Aquinas is going to attempt to answer the question, "What is evil?" Actually, I believe the answer given by Augustine that I didn't give him credit for earlier. I could have. But is evil a thing? Now, if you're a dualist, you think evil is a thing.
Yeah.
All right. So, what is evil? I'm not going to answer that question, but maybe you have a thought. By the way, if you believe in transubstantiation, you have to be a realist. In fact, the entire sacramental system, philosophically, is supported by realism and destroyed by nominalism. So you can guess what the Reformation people were interested in, which would have been nominalism. Okay? Now, the nominalist says only observe things are real. So, for example, what is a chair? The realist would say a chair is a thing you sit on. All right? The nominalist would say a chair is this thing. They'd say, this is a chair. All right? All right, you're saying, what's the difference? All right, a chair is the thing you sit on, or this is a chair. A nominalist says, this is a chair. A realist says, a chair is the thing you sit on. All right, but it's is the idea. In other words, they believed in the reality of ideas. Again, so what to Christianity? Well, turns out a lot in the Middle Ages. But the majority of the scholastics were realists. All right, the classic nominalist is going to be William of Ockham. And William of Ockham's philosophy is going to be one of the building blocks for the Reformation at some point. All right? So, there's extreme realism, which says the universals exist before the individual thing. Here's an example. Probably all of us believe in realism on some level. So, what is the number two? Is the number two real unless there are two things, all right? If there were not two of anything, would two even be a thing? All right, what about the number pi? You know? And in fact, even with the cosmological argument, are there any things that exist that God did not create? Well, what about the number two? Did God create the number two? All right, now, don't worry about it. This is, you know, these are things that they would have discussed. This would have been a big thing. And during the period of scholasticism. All right. Anyway, so we have the extreme realism, which is universals. See, realists believe in universals. All right. All right. Universals. No, there's no such thing. There's no such thing as the church unless there are Christians. All right? Now, I think I might possibly be a moderate realist myself, I think. Not that it really matters, you know. I think I might be a moderate realist. So the moderate realist says the universals are real in that there are things which are that thing. And that's what Thomas Aquinas was. Thomas Aquinas was a moderate realist. Okay? All right? So, basically, the extreme realist would say the church is a thing even if there were no Christians. The moderate realist would say there's Christians. Therefore, the church is real. And the nominalist would say there is no church. There are only Christians. Okay? Now, if you want to get rid of the papacy, which you're going to go for, you know, you see what I'm saying, all right? So you can see how nominalism, the philosophy, nominalism became the dominant philosophy in Europe in the 1400s. This practically forced some kind of change on Catholicism, whether it forced a reformation or a change within the church was going to do that was debatable. So Anselm created the satisfaction theory of atonement. Again, this goes back to our idea about salvation. If we are saved, how are we saved and by what are we saved? Now, this is not a debate your average Christian is going to care about, but throughout the Middle Ages, the accepted theory of atonement was not the satisfaction theory of atonement. All right? It was the ransom theory. In other words, basically, Jesus bought us back from Satan. We are owned by Satan, and Jesus bought us from Satan by dying for us. That was the accepted theory. This is the ransom theory. Anselm created the satisfaction theory, which says this essentially, because of God's nature, everything he is infinitely. Sin is infinitely sinful. It requires infinite restitution. Only an infinite being could make infinite atonement for infinite sin. Yet in order for a being to make atonement for human sin, he must also be human. Therefore, God had to become a man so that an infinite being could make infinite atonement infinitely for sinful sin, for infinitely sinful sin. And that is Anselm's most important thesis.
So he read Hebrews.
Hmm?
So he read Hebrews, basically.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
Kind of playing off that, you said in
scholasticism,
that That's where they started debating more.
Anything at all. There were no debates going on virtually before this.
So, I know I'm sounding redundant. I've asked this like three times, but how involved is the Bible at this point in time?
I don't know, 3%?
Yeah, it seems like that.
How involved are the writings of the church fathers? Quite a bit.
How
involved are the writings of Aristotle and Ptolemy and Boethius, the very early medieval writer in Latin, and Ovid and Cicero? Big.
So people are
huge.
Paying attention to writings, just not the Bible.
Right. That's correct. It's sad but true.
And rule of faith is still really prevalent.
Yes, the whole thing. Right. And then there's the theory of Peter Abelard, who came up with the moral exemplary theory of salvation. And according to the moral exemplary theory, Jesus became man in order to set a perfect example for us to follow. Jesus' love awakens our love for God, and because he loved us, we love God, and therefore we are saved. All right, I think I'm going to go for the satisfaction theory, but whatever you can decide on that one. I'm going to say just a tiny, tiny bit about Peter Abelard because we don't have much time. So Anselm said, I believe that I know. So the source of knowledge is belief. By the way, Augustine would have agreed with that, absolutely. And so would Luther. Augustine and Luther would have said, I believe and therefore I know. All right, but Peter Abelard said, I doubt in order to believe. So Abelard said we need to ask questions, and through asking questions, seeking logical answers to that question, we're going to discover God. And so this is your classic apologetics. Classical apologetics is the apologetics of Peter Abelard and Thomas Aquinas. So they believe we need to present a logical argument for belief. And Thomas Aquinas really believed they were going to convert Muslims by this. All right? And so we're going to see there's going to be two schools of how to convert Muslims. One is through rationally convincing them they're right. The other one is through loving them. All right? And that would be the theory of Francis of Assisi. We love them to Christ, or Dominic, or I would say Peter Abelard, we convince them of Christ. Which is the more useful apologetic? I'd say probably love them to Christ, honestly. I think I might agree with Francis of Assisi there. And having come back from the Middle East lately and talked about what's working over there, I think showing them Jesus is the way to convince them. Anyway, so Anselm says, I believe to know. Abelard says, I doubt in order to believe. He wrote Sic et Non. This was the principal work throughout from whatever it was, 1200 or so, from 1130 for the next 500 years. This was the principal book study in all universities in Europe. Every single one. All right. So Martin Luther studied Sic et Non and wrote papers on Sic et Non. Basically, yes and no. So this is a massive collection of dialectic arguments. And Abelard was the principal teacher throughout late medieval Europe. Even if he wasn't alive, I'm telling you, everybody's thesis was on Sic et Non. John Wycliffe, what was his thesis on? Sic et Non. All right? So that's Abelard. The other thing about Abelard, he had this little thing going with Heloise. The most famous romance throughout the medieval period was Peter of Abelard, Peter and Heloise. He kind of had an incestuous, not incestuous, he kind of had an affair with Heloise. Heloise's father caught him. Abelard got something cut off, which meant he wasn't going to have any more children after that. But this was the love of Heloise for Peter and Peter for Heloise. This was sort of this, you know, the whole romantic thing of the Middle Ages. because after that, Heloise became this nun and a very, very devoted nun, and Peter lived this religious life, and they were still in love with each other, but they're totally platonic. The romance between Peter Abelard and Heloise is sort of like one of the main things of the Middle Ages. Why? I don't know. But Abelard was wildly popular. Everybody wanted to learn from him. They would come from England. They would come from Italy, Germany. Thousands would come just to hear Abelard teach. Amazing. Must have been an incredible teacher. The other teachers were very jealous of this guy. All right, Hildegard. Just mention her name. She was a nun. She had mystical visions. She wrote many things. She was a very influential teacher. And popes, bishops, kings all read the preaching of Hildegard of Bingen. She was the female Peter Lombard of the day, all right? Peter Abelard, excuse me. All right, I don't say a lot about her, but there were a number of women teachers. All of them were nuns. All of them were in convents. But once you put a woman inside of a convent and a nun, there's no men around, they had a lot of freedom. So there were a number of very, very influential female writers. Many. Very influential, not just like amongst women. In other words, I'll tell you right now, men were reading women's writings. In fact, basically some of these women, if you cross them, you know, you're going to hear about it. And so there's a number of these to notice. Okay, Thomas Aquinas, probably my favorite theologian. All right, other than Paul or Jesus. All right. Now, Thomas Aquinas said, Plato, Aristotle, yes. By the 14th century, it'd be like, Aristotle said it, I believe it, and that settles it. There's a famous quote from Dante. Dante's in the book, but he didn't make my notes. I can't talk about everything. Dante Inferno. And basically he was asked, why do you believe the earth doesn't move? And he says, it's sufficient to know that Aristotle said it. That settles it. And Aristotle was baptized. So why did they put Galileo in prison for teaching that the earth moves? Because Aristotle said it doesn't move. All right, and so Aristotle became, Scholasticism centered around Aristotelian approaches to knowledge. Aristotle was a moderate realist. Okay, so Thomas Aquinas, he said, a man has free choice to the extent that he is rational. So you can see this is a rational approach to Christianity. And he believed that our rational ability was not destroyed by the fall. He didn't give it to us. God gave us anything we have, but he assigned a certain level of free will. So he basically said, no, we are not totally depraved, that we have freedom. Yes?
I'm sorry, you said Aristotle was baptized?
Well, not literally. They kind of, in quotes, baptized him. And so in the late period of the primitive church, they kind of baptized Plato. Origen, not literally.
No. Kind of like the equivalent now, like the Mormons are doing stuff like this, like where they
baptize
the dead.
No, that's not what I'm talking about. So they would say things like Socrates. I believe it might have been Origen who said Socrates was a Christian before Christ. They'd say things like that. They would say what we're teaching is absolutely consistent with the real philosophy of the really awesome Greek philosophers. What we're saying is totally consistent. Of course, then Tertullian said, what does Athens have to do with Jerusalem? And there's two different ideas on that. All right. So he believed that God reveals himself through the scriptures, but also through reasoning. In other words, the idea of God is reasonable. And he believed any reasonable person, by looking at one of his five arguments for the existence of God, would have to believe in God. And he published five arguments for the existence of God in his awesome book, Summa Theologica. God is the unmoved mover. If anything moves, something gets it to move. So what's the unmoved mover? This is essentially these two are versions of the cosmological argument. The argument from contingency. All right, this is the uncaused cause, essentially. The argument from degree and the teleological argument. this is the argument from design. The argument I use for the existence of God in my apologetic work, the principal argument I use, would be the teleological argument. All right, for what it's worth. I mean, that's just true, okay? So he provided a systematic arguments for the existence of God. He studied in Paris. He did stutter also, probably. In fact, he was known for being, I believe he literally did stutter. He was not a very, very good public speaker. He studied under the greatest teacher of his time, who he replaced, which is Albertus Magnus. All right, his name was not Albertus Magnus. His name was Albertus, but Albertus the Great. Of Thomas, he said, "You call him a dumb ox. I tell you, this dumb ox will bellow so loud that his bellowings will fill the world." And that was true. I've got Chesterton's book here. It's very thin. This is a classic, Chesterton's book on Thomas Aquinas. It's a great read. This is the classic. If you want to read about Thomas Aquinas, it's less than 100 pages. So anyway, I suggest that one. Here's how Chesterton puts it. He reconciled Aristotle to Christ, not vice versa. So Thomas Aquinas' enemy said, "You're turning Christianity into Aristotelianism." But that is not a fair charge. It really is not. I agree with Chesterton that basically he used Aristotle to support Christianity and not vice versa. All right? He replaced Augustine. So after Aquinas, the principal theologian of Catholicism absolutely was Thomas Aquinas, not Augustine. And I would argue he single-handedly saved Catholicism from Augustine. And really, the Reformation was a move backward, not forward. So we start over here, Augustine. We move towards Christ over here with Thomas Aquinas. And then Calvin, Zwingli, and Luther take us back over to here. They moved in the wrong direction. That's my opinion. All right. He minimized experiential aspects of Christianity. His Christianity was very intellectual. That's not necessarily completely good. His best friend was this guy Bonaventure. And Bonaventure was a total heart Christian. I mean, the fact that these two guys were best buddies is really interesting. Because Bonaventure was totally into mysticism, and love, and, you know, feelings and all that kind of stuff. His best buddy is Thomas Aquinas, who's a total abstract philosopher kind of guy. That's very interesting that they were such close friends. Bring the two together and you got a pretty full Christian right there. But anyway, he did not accept strict monergism. By the way, I put the word monergism up on an earlier slide. I think I forgot to define it at the time. Monergism is the idea that all the impulse towards salvation is coming from one side, and that is from God. In other words, absolutely nothing we do has any effect whatsoever to ultimately bring about our salvation. That it's 100% of God, end of story. And that is Augustine, and that is Calvin, and that is Luther, and that is Zwingli, but that is not Thomas Aquinas. God, therefore, is the first cause who moves causes both natural and voluntary. And just as moving natural causes, he does not prevent their actions from being natural, so by moving voluntary causes, he does not deprive their actions of being voluntary. But rather, he is the one, the cause of this very thing in them, for he operates in everything according to its own nature. In other words, trees always obey God, because God created trees so that they always obey him. In fact, everything God ever created obeys him perfectly. What's the only exception? Us. And probably angels. Right, probably angels. I don't know about that, but all right. And so basically, he said, God's sovereignty is not lessened by the fact that we are sovereign. That's what he's saying. Our sovereignty is imputed to us. If we have free will, the reason we have free will is because God decided that we should have free will. And if God decides that we have free will, is that undermining his sovereignty? He says, far from it, it makes God greater, not less. And I have to say, I agree with Thomas Aquinas. But I'm telling you right now, Augustine would not agree with that at all. Are you kidding? Now, if you ask Thomas Aquinas, he would say he's a monergist. But he wasn't. Come on, look what he just said. All right? Anyway, basically what Thomas Aquinas said, God predestines those he foreknew. Now, you know, in Romans 8:29, it says, those he foreknew, he also predestined. Those he predestined, he called. Those he called, he justified. And those he justified, he glorified. There are two possible interpretations of that statement. One is, there's people that God foreknew would be saved, and those he, you know, predestined, called, justified, and glorified. Or it could be that God chose. In other words, the first act of God was predestining. But I disagree. In other words, I believe God predestined all of us to salvation. God desires all men to come to the truth and all that kind of stuff, okay? So many passages. Any doctrine that does not allow that God wants all people to be saved is horrible theology. It's terrible theology. Mr. is totally right. I'm with him 100%. Because if you are a double predestinationist, if you're a monergist, you mean you believe that God created evil. And God created a lot more evil people than good people. All right, so why is there evil? Is evil a thing? The way both Augustine and Aquinas described evil, they said, evil is the corruption of something that was good if it had not been decided by a free person to, essentially, that's what Thomas Aquinas would say, a free person freely uses a good thing in a bad way and evil comes into the world. So evil is the corruption of something that is good. The way that both Aquinas and Augustine would say, anything that's evil is something that was good, but because of misuse by a choice of a person, it made it not good. And think about that, whether you agree with that or not, I don't know, but that's his answer to that question. So the Manichees, Augustine, Luther, and Calvin said, God is the author of both good and evil. Physical things and pleasure are essentially sinful and bad. Aquinas said, God is the author of only good things. Physical things are good, and pleasure is not necessarily evil. I think I prefer Thomas Aquinas. In fact, I think he's right. Because what did God say after he created everything? He said everything was good. How good? Very good. How many bad things did God create? None. How many bad things did God allow to exist? Well, quite a few. Why? Because he loves us. All right? So, to Aquinas, evil is not a thing. It's the result of corruption of a thing which would have been good if it had not been corrupted by a person with free will who chose to use it in a corrupted way. Good can exist without evil, whereas evil cannot exist without good. See that? Good can exist without evil. Of course, he's a realist, right? When he says good can exist without evil, this is not a novelist. This is a realist. He said good can exist without evil, but evil cannot exist without good, right? So that's his statement of the nature of evil. All right? The Reformed say, in Adam's fall, we sinned all. Thomas says, the divine nature was damaged by the fall, but not destroyed. Remember, I asked the question, what happened at the fall? Thomas Aquinas says, our free will was damaged, but not destroyed. Right or wrong, I'll let you decide. That's food for thought. I personally say I find this idea interesting, attractive, possibly even right. Okay. I love Thomas Aquinas because, and with every question, he asks the first thing, which is, what does common sense say? You know, he allowed common sense to influence how he interpreted things. Rather than starting with some assumption, which may or may not be true, and then... Because Calvinism is based on an assumption. And at every step, you know, TULIP, every single step of TULIP is nonsense, right? But every single step of TULIP is logical if you accept the prior step. So Thomas Aquinas says, every time you take a step, ask, does it make sense? If it doesn't make sense, it's probably not true. Let's go somewhere else. So he's considered a common sense philosopher. Thanks to Thomas Aquinas, in my opinion, Roman Catholic theology is more Christian than most Protestant theology. Now, remember we talked about heteropraxy and heterodoxy? Yeah. Roman Catholicism is heteropraxy to the nth degree. Now, my attempt, you asked that question, is that a doctrine or a practice? I'm acting as if there's a simple, clear division. Maybe the Word of God can divide between a practice and doctrine. I don't think I can. But just as a sort of a generic way of thinking about it. All right, the Reformation did wonders to heteropraxy, but it stunk when it comes to heterodoxy. Okay, Roger Bacon, I don't really have time for. I mean, Roger Bacon, this is the first scientist. How can I not do Roger? Man, Roger Bacon, he's my hero. He created science. Oh, I forgot to do my slides here. All right, Aquinas believed in free will. There you go. Roger Bacon. Basically, Roger Bacon was the first nominalist. A nominalist is almost also an empiricist. Remember, Greg said yesterday that the Restoration Movement leaders were empiricists. They were Baconian. By the way, they were not Roger Baconian, just so you know. They were Francis Baconian. There's two Bacons. Well, there's three Bacons. The kind you have for breakfast. There's Roger and Francis, okay? Francis Bacon was another empiricist, but he was 350 years after Roger Bacon. So Roger Bacon said, the things that are true are things that we can observe. So he rejects realism. He rejects universals. He says the only things that are real are things you can observe. And so he said, let's start observing. If we want to understand nature, let's observe nature and let nature tell us what's true rather than telling nature what ought to be true. I mean, this was the foundation of modern science. If it were not for Christianity, there would be no science. If it were not for Christianity, there would be no science. What are the basic assumptions of science? Number one, is there exists a single set of unchanging laws. Why would anybody believe in a single set of unchanging laws? Because they believe in a single unchanging God. He also believed that nature is understandable, that we human beings can actually understand how nature works. Why did he believe that? Because he believed in general revelation, that God revealed himself through his creation. He also said that nature will be mathematical. And again, because he believed that nature is ordered, created by an orderly God. And so the fundamental assumptions of science were all created by a monk named Roger Bacon, who was a nominalist, but I'm going to skip to William of Ockham. Okay? Little section of Bonaventure, who's basically the theologian of the heart, the theologian of love. I mean, we should talk more about that. I'm talking about all this intellectual stuff. We should talk about Bonaventure. Bonaventure was a heart Christian. He was a heart theologian. He was a heart scholastic, which makes him kind of stick out a little bit in his age. He was like best friends. The birth and death dates for Bonaventure are almost identical to Thomas Aquinas, if you look back. William of Ockham, some people say he's the first of the reformers. They say the great reformers are Ockham, Luther, Zwingli, and Calvin. I think that's overblown. I think that's giving too much credit to philosophy, because William of Ockham was a philosopher. He was not a reformer. He didn't start a church movement. All right, he did start an intellectual movement that overtook Christianity that eventually produced the Reformation. So that's pretty good. But he did not start a movement. He didn't have followers. So I would put a question mark there. and say not really, but he was an empiricist. He led this empiricist movement. He rejected the idea of innate ideas or universals. Right? Things do not exist unless it's an observable thing. The only things that are real are observable things. Therefore, he was a fideist. He said, this whole attempt of Thomas Aquinas to prove the existence of God, nonsense. The reason we know God's real is because we experience him. Because we pray and things happen. And so he was an empiricist even in his apologetics. He was the philosopher most responsible, if we can say any philosopher, for bringing in the Reformation. Okay? He was from Ockham, which is in England, but he published his thesis on nominalism, which seems to make sacramentalism bad. The whole idea of ex opere operato was undermined. The entire system of sacramentalism, people figured this out really, really quickly. They said, this guy, very young, just wrote his thesis. They sent him to Avignon, where the popes were. We'll talk about that really quickly. Yeah, we will. We'll have some time for that. Okay. Condemned as a heretic, but he was not executed. He, along with two friends, escaped from Avignon, which is in southeast France, where the popes were at that time. He went to Munich in Germany. He was protected by the emperor there. He lived the rest of his life as going to hell, but not yet. You know, you don't go to hell until later. We don't kill you right now. Anyway, he was a nominalist. He rejected the innate ideas. Therefore, he rejected sacramentalism. His rejection of realism and rationalism led to the rejection of scholasticism and therefore to the Reformation. Now, and to be honest with you, to explain why nominalism means Reformation, I haven't done a good job there. But I kind of need to go on to the next thing. Otherwise, by the way, if you notice, I've got maybe half an hour worth of voice left. So I have to kind of finish for that reason, if nothing else. But anyway, he strongly argued for the separation of church and state, because church is not a thing. And so church and state have no natural relationship between them. He says the church comprises the whole of all believers. The community of Christians, that is the church. Every believer is a member of the Christian community. This is the Reformation, right? This is the Reformation. This is the main idea of the Reformation. The church is not a thing. The church is believers. And who does the Bible belong to? The believers. Who does the priesthood belong to? The believers. Who does the Lord's Supper belong to? The believers, right? But really, this is humanism. I mean, this is the advent of humanism. This is the advent of the Renaissance. The idea of the dignity of individuals rather than the group as a whole. That's humanism. All right. Now, I'm going to talk about Francis of Assisi and Dominic here. All right. I like Francis of Assisi. I don't like Dominic very much at all. I find him to be kind of repulsive. Francis of Assisi, you can see I'm actually going backward in time slightly, not forward. He was on the road. He saw a poor soldier in rags. See, he was a child of wealth, fairly wealthy. He was going to inherit his father's wealth. He sees this soldier who's in rags. He takes up all his really good clothes. He gives them to the soldier, says, "Give me your rags." And he walks away with his rags. That was his conversion event. He decided to lead the apostolic life. His father wasn't too happy about that. His father kidnapped him. This was a deprogramming. You've heard about deprogramming? Yeah. He got deprogrammed by his father. He escaped from his house. He wandered around for months and months. Became a mendicant friar. He began the group known as the Brown Friars. He was a lover of nature. He was a lover of experience. To him, Christianity was about experiencing the love of God. The love of God is not something to be discussed in a classroom. Francis of Assisi wouldn't be caught dead in a classroom. He was in the fields and looking at the trees. If you read about him, did I bring my book on Francis of Assisi? Here we go. Bonaventure. I mentioned Bonaventure. Bonaventure is after Francis of Assisi. Bonaventure's description of Francis of Assisi is really awesome. It's beautiful. The guy was a bit of a space case. You know, he's not Mr. Practical there. But I have to say that his idea of Christ brought people back towards Christ, and that's always a good thing. So basically then, what he did was he spent his father's money rebuilding churches. His father wasn't too happy about that. All right? Seizing him without mercy, he dragged into his house, reproaching and tormenting him with words, blows, and bonds. But his mother opened the door and let him go, and he never came back. Francis's Christianity was experiential. It was mystical. You know what? I think our Christianity needs to be experiential. It needs to be mystical. And I believe the Holy Spirit plays that role for us. To the extent we call ourselves back to the Holy Spirit, I believe we're calling ourselves back to the spirit of Francis of Assisi. He was a lover of nature. Supposedly the sparrows would come and light on his shoulder. And there's all these stories. Probably most of them are not true. I think what is true is he was just in love with nature because he saw God revealed through nature. All right? Despite his severe asceticism, he was a happy Christian. He practically invented happy Christianity, which is, I mean, this guy was the ascetic of all ascetics. He hardly ate anything, skinny, wore the cheapest clothes, barely even kept himself alive. He was such a radical ascetic, and yet he loved life. I mean, smiling and happy. Anybody who's not enjoying Christianity is not a Christian. I mean, he and Dominic are so opposites. Dominic is this angry, dour, sad, you know, depressed Christian. But Francis of Assisi loved life. All right? He founded the Friars Minor in 1208. Now, the Pope Innocent III, who was probably the most powerful of all popes, I took a whole section on Innocent III out. Read about Innocent III. This guy was, megalomaniac of all megalomaniacs. Oh, my goodness. The thing is, he had the power. He was the king of Europe. He was the emperor of all Europe. This guy. Whew. But he was smart. And he said, we need to stop anathematizing these guys. We need to support them. Now, they didn't allow the Franciscans to teach on theology, but they allowed them to teach about repentance and holy living and prayer. They allowed them to teach about the things that are probably important anyway. So Innocent said, go for it. Yes, you guys can be monks. And now we start to have the idea of a friar. A friar is not something you buy in the store for $1.99 a pound. A friar is somebody who is an ascetic but not a monk. And at this point, common people could come into the ascetic life. Up to this time, unless you had some money, unless you had some connections, you couldn't even join a monastery. You couldn't be a monk. So thousands flocked not into the priesthood, not even into being a monk, but into being friars. That just means brothers. So we wouldn't call, you call a monk a father or something like that. You call a friar, when you say friar, frère, mon frère, right? Brother. These people were brothers. Okay, and so most of the people involved in the committed ascetic life were now friars, not necessarily monks. Okay? They went throughout the countryside. They're itinerant preachers. Now, remember, during the Council of Chalcedon, all monks were under a bishop. But the Franciscans were under the Pope. Of course, this is Innocent III who controls everything. He's taking power away from the bishops. So these guys weren't subject to the local bishop. They could go wherever they want. See, monks could not go somewhere. I mean, if your bishop says you stay here, guess what? You stay here, all right? That was one of their vows, is obedience. All right? So the Franciscans went all over the place. They connected the church with the common people. That seems like a really good thing, actually. They preached a simple love, the apostolic life. They tried to humanize Jesus, which he already was human, but they tried to connect people with the humanity of Jesus. He made Christianity more emotional, less rational. He was the one who created the first nativity scenes. And, you know, the nativity scene is humanizing Jesus. Jesus is a baby in a manger. When he did that, that was a theological statement. When he put Jesus in a manger, he was making a theological statement about the love of Jesus and about his humanity. He was the first one to put crucifixes up. They had crosses. What they'd never had is Jesus on a cross. That's why that picture there. All right? And he made the cross an adoration of Jesus on the cross. I mean, because of him, Catholicism became about the crucifixion to a very large extent. The passion of Christ. The sacred heart. That whole the sacré cœur. This goes back to Francis of Assisi. He created a sensation. By 1300, there were at least 12,000 Franciscan friars in Europe. That's a lot. How many Catholic monks are there today? How many Catholic priests are there in the entire world today? Probably not much over 12,000. Okay, great. Dominic, last time on Dominic, how am I doing? I've been going for about 50, 55 minutes. I'll go 5 more minutes. Then we'll do one more session. Dominic, he's the exact opposite of St. Francis of Assisi. And yet the two principal movements of Catholicism at the time were the Dominicans and the Franciscans, which is interesting. All right, and you got the two wings, you know. If you're this kind of person, you're a Dominican. If you're this kind of person, you're a Franciscan. So which was Thomas Aquinas, by the way? He's a Dominican. Which was Luther? Neither. He was an Augustinian. All right. And by the way, Roger Bacon was a Dominican. Okay. Dominic, he was loved learning. Francis Bacon wouldn't be caught dead in a classroom. Dominic spent most of his time in a classroom. Okay, got it? His career was launched when he observed unsuccessful attempts to defeat the Cathars in debates. He realized, we have to get smarter. We need to learn how to defeat them in debates. This is embarrassing. Now, what Francis of Assisi would say, lead a Christian life superior to theirs. Be more Christian than they are. But Dominic would say, no. Be smarter than they are and win the debates. By the way, you could argue that his view won out over Francis of Assisi in some ways. So his practical solution was, number one, learn how to defeat them in debates, and number two, persuade Catholics to live the apostolic lifestyle. The one thing both Dominic and Francis had in common was their commitment to the apostolic lifestyle, which is to live a Christ-like life as interpreted in medieval times, which is to deny pleasure primarily. Okay? So Francis says, win the heretics and the Muslims by loving them. Dominic says, win them by defeating their arguments, or if not, killing them. Okay? Like I said, the Dominicans, they were created as an order, 9 years after the Franciscans. They were devoted to the life of the mind. They became the chief educators in Europe. Most of the professors in these universities formed by Scholasticism were Dominicans. Most of them were. They also became the militant arm of the papacy, and they became the instrument of the Inquisition. All the inquisitors, or nearly all of them, were Dominicans. Okay? A popular story about Dominic, though probably not true, illustrates his character and how distinct he was from the Francis of Assisi. As the story goes, Dominic was interrupted in his studies by a noisy sparrow. Dominic captured the bird and plucked its feathers because it was interrupting his studies. Right? First of all, Francis would never get caught studying, whereas Dominic was put study before most other activities. Second, far from being annoyed by the chirping bird, Francis would have stopped studying right away and spent time loving the bird and petting it and all that kind of stuff. All right. Now, let's take our break. I think we only went about 50 minutes, but we're probably going to do about another 50 minutes. We're probably going to end 15 or 20 minutes early, if my voice can even last that long. So, you're not supposed to say cool. You're supposed to say, oh, man, how tragic is that?